my name is John Gatto. Wow, I said. He said, listen, I paid every cent my family had to get a principal's license. He said, and now nobody will talk to me. I beg you to find some way to discriminate yourself from me. And that's how I became John Taylor Gatto, although I'm related to the guy who invented an industrial process called time and motion studies, where somebody watches you at your machine and then notifies you that you're going to the bathroom by a circuitous route and cheating your employer out of so much time. They watch everything you do. Your elbow moves wrong, they'll tell you. It's 1 second a day times a 40-year working career. We're talking big time theft. So anyway, I'm from Monongahela, Pennsylvania, where a movie has just been made about a little coal mining, steelworking town of 4,500 people. The movie's name is One Extraordinary Street. And that film is about the number of well-known people who've come out of Monongahela in one generation around the Second World War. The current Army Chief of Staff is from Monongahela. The co-inventor of the pacemaker or pacemaker device is from Monongahela. The founder of the Disney Channel is from Monongahela. A National Book Award winner, Deidre Baer, had an editorial in the New York Times last week, is from Monongahela. The inventor of the Smurf football, 7 million sold, is from Monongahela. Joe Montana, easily the greatest quarterback and artist of football in history, from Monongahela. The highest scorer in Minnesota Viking football history is from Monongahela. And my Uncle Bud, who didn't graduate from high school, but came back from the Second World War, and his first job was head of the Rockwell manufacturing plant in Bellefontaine, Ohio. 8,000 employees, its own railroad siding. He's from Monongahela, I'm from Monongahela, and I really could go on. What was the magic of Monongahela? I mean, all these people in a coal mining town just before and just after, during the Second World War. Well, maybe we'll start with this in public school, that in sixth grade, everybody read Caesar's Gallic War. Oh, is he getting hoity-toity? We don't have the luxury of ancient Rome. Well, that's not how it was sold to us coal miner kids. It was sold to us as the textbook of divide-and-conquer strategy, where a small force can overwhelm a much larger force by setting them against one another in competition and dividing them from their natural ally. You'd have to be a fool not to be interested. Furthermore, we were told it was taught in every great university in the world for the past 2,000 years. Then in ninth grade Monongahela, we had a choice. Not everyone took it. Of taking the book and reading it in Latin. Gallias dominus duis in partes tres. Quorum unum in colon belgae. Aliam aquatoni. Qui absor. And I've picked it up in Latin or English for, let's see, about 65 years. Then in ninth grade, everybody had to read Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. Ah, this really rarefied stuff. We don't have the luxury of that right. Well, that's not how it was sold to steelworker kids and coal miner kids. It was sold this way. Only once in the history of the human race has the single strongest, most powerful human being and the wealthiest human being combined in one body opened his mind and showed you how he thought. Would anyone be jerky enough to prefer the Beatles if they had a chance to worm their way in the minds of Mr. Big? Let me tell you. Okay, that was school in Monongahela, Pennsylvania. When I got to Cornell University, I was so bored by the low level of what was offered that I began to chase girls. And when the girl I was chasing graduated and went to New York City, I quickly transferred to Columbia University, not realizing that a girl with a diploma had no interest in a college junior. However, the curriculum at Columbia was so intensely low-grade and boring, that although I got through, I had other interests. I guess it was girls, too. Now I'm old enough to look back on that and smile. I've only been given an hour and 45 minutes here, which for an Italian and a microphone, listen, you got to see some of Mussolini's speeches. So just in the event, A, that you think, well, he went all over the place, what was he talking about? The keynote theme here is you must remove your cooperation from this institution. And that can mean anything at all, from voting down your school taxes to actually doing some harm to the institution. That's against the law for me to tell you, if you're a teacher, for example, what harm you can do to the institution. Just teaching well and deviating from the assigned curriculum is doing enormous harm to the institution. I was fired from my first teaching job in Harlem. I was substituting for a Spanish class, and I speak approximately 100 words of Spanish, but I do know how to tell time. So I asked the kids if they know how to tell time. They said no, and I said, it only takes 15 minutes, so I'll teach you all to tell time. By the third class, the principal in this all-black school, who was nominally white but came in with a purplish-red face with steam coming out of her ear, took me out in the hall, told me I had destroyed the entire curriculum for the month of June. And how would she explain that to the teacher ready to when she returned? She said, you'll never be hired at this school again. Wow. Wow. Next school I taught at was in Spanish Harlem. They gave me a remedial reading class, third grade. I said, what a boat ride. Until a little girl named Milagros Maldonado came up to the desk and said, I don't belong in this class. I can read anything. And I said, now, my dear. Now, I must tell you, I was teaching on a borrowed teaching lesson. They didn't have pictures in those days. My college roommate at Cornell had a license until one day came home, threw the license in the drawer and said, you'd have to be an imbecile to do that for a living. Then he went to work as a waiter at the Bull and Bear restaurant at the Waldorf Astoria. And if I tell you he was coming home every night with $500 to $1,000 in cash tips and throwing them in the dresser drawer until the drawer was so full of money, he said, well, that's it. I'm going to the Virgin Islands and open a restaurant, which he did. It's still down there. It's called the Club Comanche in St. Thomas. Wow. I was in between advertising jobs because about 150 of us had been fired for claiming that Colgate shaving cream shaved sandpaper. But what we did was scatter sand grains on a sheet of glass, and then in the ad it looked like, but the truth is your fingernail could have shaved that kind of sandpaper. The FCC descended on us. The whole agency was dispersed all over New York City to find a sheet of sandpaper so cheap that you could shave it with Colgate shaving cream. We were not successful. We were all turned out. But there was Dick Bone's teaching license. So now I was a school teacher, and now I'm in Spanish Harlem, having been fired from my first job for teaching black kids how to tell time in Spanish. And now I'm in a remedial reading class, and this little girl is telling me that she knows how to read. Now, my dear, this is all done scientifically for your own good. And she grabbed a huge book from the teacher's desk and said, open it anywhere, and I'll read it without a mistake. So I cracked it open to the Devil and Daniel Webster. Sounds like an easy story until you refresh your acquaintance with it. The sentences are hundreds of words long. They're written in the Latinate fashion, so you don't know what the sentence is about until you get to the end of it, not at the beginning like an English sentence, etc., etc. Well, she read it flawlessly. And I said, well, Milagros, look, on lunch here I'll speak to the principal and I know you'll be moved. Now, in this all-Hispanic school, the principal, of course, was pale white, never having seen a day of the sun, but her face immediately turned to this purplish red shade of anger. She said, Mr. Gatto, you're very naive. These children will memorize a story to make it appear that they can read. I thought about that for about a 40th of a second. I said, if this girl could memorize the Devil and Daniel Webster, which I could barely read. Something strange is going on. So she said, I will come in after school and I will show you, and then you will never be hired at this school again. Well, she comes in and Milagros could stand on her head, you know, and read those sentences backwards. She was so good, as I was at her age. I mean, I went to school in first grade. The last thing my mother and I read together was Matthew Arnold's epic poem about Persian nobility called Sohrab and Rustum. You can't even find it today. So the first grade teacher, lovely woman with silver white hair, Miss Dane, allowed you to read until you made a mistake. Well, reading about talking choo-choos, I mean, this would be the hour would start and the hour would finish. I'd still be reading. She came to our home and begged my mother to get me to stop raising my hand. She said, it's ruining the class. But the reason I could read isn't because I had undergone phonics training or whole word training. It's simply that my mother read to me every single day. She had contempt for what are known as children's books, and rightly so. And we read, and I watched her finger move under the... How many times can you see your mama's finger under the letter T before you know the variant pronunciations of the letter T? And that is how America learned to read for centuries. You weren't allowed... Nobody knows this. You weren't allowed to go to most schools in the 19th century, first grade, unless you knew how to read, because nobody wanted to waste their time doing that. The Germans figured out a way, though, to stop people from learning how to read well. And Horace Mann's wife had the American license to sell the program. It was called, well, in today's language, Whole Word, where you memorized, actually the Germans made you memorize whole paragraphs. It came to this country, you had to memorize whole sentences, but then in its simplified version, you memorize whole words. And in the early grades, people who've done that appear to be far ahead of people who've cracked the sound code. But that runs out, that superiority, in the third grade. And suddenly, the people who memorize whole words can't read anything except talking choo-choo books. And that's exactly the way the Germans wanted it 2 centuries ago. And that's the system Horace Mann poured into this. You can see why Italians with microphones have to work from scripts. And I've written my hand to the bone since I got here, and I'm about 2/3 of the way through this talk. So I better begin. But before I begin, I've got to introduce you to what I believe is one of the most important books, say the 5 most important I ever read in my life. It's published by a Canadian lady named Wendy Prisnitz. Anyone in here know Wendy or know of her? Good. Tell her that I'm her biggest fan. This is by a French-Canadian farmer named Leandre Bergeron. Forgive my French pronunciation, but I went to Catholic boarding school in third grade, and if you mispronounce French, they struck you on the hand with a wooden ruler, and if you mispronounced it twice, with a metal ruler. So I don't speak French any longer, even though I spoke it pretty well in third grade. Leandre Bergeron is a stupid title for the sake of our children, but the content is as revolutionary as any book I ever read in my life. 40 miles north of Montreal, for the sake of our children, Leandre had in quick succession 3 daughters with his wife. And he made the decision with the first daughter to raise all his children, I'm using his own expression, as honored guests in his home. Now, hey, isn't that the usual BS about I love children? No, he meant it. Would you tell an honored guest when to get up in the morning? No. Would you tell an honored guest when to go to bed at night? Would you tell an honored guest they had to wash the dishes, sweep the floor? No, you wouldn't do that. He didn't do that with any of his daughters. He didn't teach them anything at all or give them any commands at all that they were compelled to follow. The 3 of them are in their 20s now. One of them has an independent art service in Montreal doing work for television, for magazines, book jackets. One of them is a horse trainer in Montreal, but also a farrier, which I think means she puts horseshoes on. And the 3rd one is the hospitality director of a 4-star hotel. How is that possible? Raised by a crazy Frenchman who didn't open his mouth. Well, the whole story's in here. The book's about as long as Ben Franklin's autobiography. And I'd recommend both books to be read, because Franklin talked about the solution to the school problem, which I won't live to see, but some of you younger people might. It's to refold children back into the living community entirely back, to call childhood over at the age of 7, because that's what your screaming brats are telling you. Stop locking me up in this insane world as an incomplete human being. Could I prove that to you? Only by abandoning part of my formal talk. I first got wind of this when somebody left behind on an airplane seat a copy of Richard Branson's autobiography. Mr. Branson, not my favorite human being, nevertheless, the 22nd wealthiest human being in the world, and in some of his businesses, a benefactor to mankind and to womankind, which is a separate planet. At age four, picture four now, Mr. Branson's mother, an airline stewardess in the 1940s, when that was really Russian roulette, transatlantic airline hostess, so seldom home, drove Richard miles from their London home and said to him, "Richard, do you think you could find your way home alone from here?" And the four-year-old said, "I think I could." And she said, "Well, get out and do so then." And off she drove, not to a safe vantage point to watch little Richard, but she went home. 8 or 10 hours later, when Richard got home, as he says in his autobiography, "I knew that nothing in the world was difficult to do, and never again did I feel fear in the presence of a challenge." He didn't waste his time on high school. He didn't waste his time on college. By the age of 19, he had the first of dozens of profitable businesses, coming from quite a modest background. And last year, on the front page of national newspapers everywhere in the world, Richard was shown standing next to his mother, Eve, in front of a working spaceship he had just completed, which will take flight this fall with 250 people as paying passengers, cost $250,000 a ticket, and don't try to get one. They're all sold out. That's Richard Branson at age 4. Now, that's pretty long in the tooth if you compare him to the world's greatest golfer, Tiger Woods, who those of you who use the internet, I threw my computer away, but those of you who use the internet will be able to find Tiger Woods at age 2. That's 2. That's 730 days teaching putting on television. The clip from the TV show is up there. Age 2, age 4. Last year, year before last, in the New Yorker magazine, probably the most dynamic artist in the world today, with major shows in every continent except Antarctica, Carol Walker was being interviewed at a fancy Paris restaurant. Her 4-year-old daughter, Octavia, was with her, and Carol was receiving the praise of French journalists from opening a show featuring 40-foot long, 20-foot high paintings of the sexual depredations of white plantation owners on black female slaves in graphic detail. Just sort of imagine And that's all Kara Walker does, one after another after another. So every possible grotesque pornographic possibility has been explored by Kara Walker. What I didn't tell you was Octavia is one of Kara's leading advance people. She makes appointments, she checks the physical housing of the painting, she makes sure. She's 4 years old. In the middle of the interview, when it had exceeded 1 hour, suddenly Octavia Walker broke the interview up. You can Google this in the New Yorker, except last night on TV at about midnight there was a documentary about Google, and apparently they saved every single Google request you ever make in a personal file, and then they sell the information. Anyway, back to Kara Walker. Octavia jumps up and shouts, "Kara Walker, Kara Walker, when is it going to be my turn?" You put yourself back in your pre-12 years, and unless you were drowned with diseased talking choo-choo books and soft, cuddly toys past the age of 7, you too were Octavia Walker. And if you look in early American history, you find that George Washington was studying trigonometry at age 10, geometry, and surveying. That's at age 10. By age 12, he had abandoned formal schooling and was teaching himself naval architecture, scientific agriculture, access to positions of power, which I think in those days might have been known as political science, and he was growing a crop of marijuana. In his journal, he says, "for medicinal purposes," which is how everybody used it, right? To escape the disease of modern law. Anyway. So I'm going to get to the prepared talk. As soon as I tell you about a piece of mail I received before I came up here from an Italian family, their flyers in Italian and English, and it says, it's a picture of a man and a woman with florid Italian gestures and a fancy hat and 1, 2, 3, 4 little bambini, and they aren't going to school. They're taking a 4-month walk together through the Alps. Our impressions along the way will be recorded in diaries, paintings, drawings, and photographs. We will walk for 120 days, collecting experiences and stories along the way. We are walking because this is the most human way to travel. We are walking at a leisurely pace. We want to meet you and all sorts of people and invite you to walk some part of the way with us. And then here's my next door neighbor in upstate New York, who a week ago, I didn't know the woman, a week ago when I was speaking at the public library in Norwich, New York, where they make the aspirins, pressed a book on me. There's nothing somebody who writes books likes less than having a book pressed on them, let me tell you. And yet, almost all the valuable reading I've done in the last 20 years has come this way. So picture the lady, her 2 children, and 2 people, obviously not her children. The book's called Freedom, Fun, Genius, Turning Learning into Another Stupid Type. And I'll tell her that when I see her. She just got so bored with the kids' schooling, even though she had very, very little money and an old Jeep, that she said, look, we're going to go around the United States in 33 days in the Jeep, and you guys have to budget. Here's the money we have. We will not be able to sleep in motels or eat in restaurants. So you plan this thing out so the money fits. While she was waiting to kick off, a neighbor came and said, listen, I'm helping this emotionally disturbed young girl, and I think it would be the making of the kid if you could take her along in your old Jeep. So Johanna said, okay. And unfortunately, that precedent spread. And another neighbor came and I said, I've been working with this emotionally disturbed young boy. And could you take him along in your old Jeep around the United States in 30s? And she said, yes. There. And the I'm not going to bother to tell you about the son of the guy who wrote Jonathan Livingston Seagull, who was declared an independent minor, some legal term like that. Craney Stowe would know what it is. At the age of 14, because he was so rotten, filthy, and inhuman, and stupid, that his father didn't want him around anymore, and he didn't want to be around his father anymore. That was at age 14. But his father had a few bucks, so he paid for a motel for the kid. That was at 14. He'd never touched a computer in his life. And by the age of 20, no schooling, no tutoring, he was project director at Apple Computer in Cupertino, California. Wow, how did that miracle happen? Well, that miracle is nothing compared to what I fished out of yesterday's USA Today. There's a list of the world's 20 largest economies. Every single one of them is in deficit, meaning they spend more than they earn. The United States, for example's deficit is, hold it just a second, it's 96% of what we earn we owe. So unless you wanted nothing from the government for the next year, it's going to be a long time before we're out of debt. One country, however, has a healthy budget surplus. Does anyone know what that country is? And I don't like to play speakers' games, but I do like to get some feedback so I can know how to do better with the next audience. It's the nation of Brazil, which is a healthy deficit. And what I think is the most interesting thing about Brazil is that its president, under which this surplus occurred, grew up in those hideous ghettos of those hillside favelas, I think. Probably my accent's bad in Spanish too, right, Craney? These horrible slums that you've probably seen in documentary movies. He grew up there. He didn't go to school. He wasn't tutored at all. But he's the president of Brazil. He's reelected. Every other national president of these sinking nations who can't pay their bill is well-schooled. I almost misspoke and said educated. They're well-schooled, and they're surrounded by well-schooled people, and they don't know what the hell they're doing. His name's Lula da Silva. Okay, and now... I'm going to have to turn it very fast. And I have to work from Scripture, otherwise we'll have to lock the door and you'll have to miss lunch. So, it's called the fourth purpose, and the keynote idea is that you must withdraw your cooperation. You cannot completely protect yourself by bowing your head and then taking care of your own, although that certainly is the strategy that most of us use, and if you need to use that, it's certainly better than nothing. So part one is called Questions. Why must kids be schooled like fish? Not a smart remark. It's the only way the word is used other than with your children. Brazil, the only major nation in the world running a budgetary surplus, not a debt, is currently headed by a man who grew up without any schooling in the horrible slums of Rio de Janeiro. How is that possible? And that is not a rhetorical question. When you begin to answer how that's possible, you will suddenly see that you are your own prisoner, as you're meant to be. And why do schools teach what they teach? Who decided, and for what reasons? Do you actually know? It's a mystery to most people. If John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie came from the poorest of families without any connections and did almost entirely without schooling, why do your own kids need it? If George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Francis S. Collins, head of the Human Genome Project, had almost no schooling, why must your own kids jump when school bells ring? If the founders of Microsoft, Apple, Dell, Oracle, CNN, IKEA, the Whole Foods markets, McDonald's, Wendy's, Burger King, Taco Bell, Avis Rent-A-Car, and Walmart have no college degrees, why should your son or daughter need one? How did this racket get started? How does it sustain itself? Why should you withdraw your cooperation from this project? Part two, comparisons. The ancient Athenians had no rooms where boys and girls spent their entire youth or even a single day obeying orders from strangers. There was no remote control homework in Athens. The only tests allowed were performance tests. And what was tested wasn't dangling participles. It was strength, agility, beauty, imagination, command of language, reasoning power, courage, honorable behavior, dependability, and self-reliance. So get rid of the straitjacket of subjects. Nothing called a subject has any existence at all. The application of learning is where your kids' opportunities and your own are going to lie. Not in memorizing subjects, and there are no known correlations between high test scores or high grade point averages and anything that any sane person considers valuable. The admissions director at Harvard told me flatly, this is 4 years ago, her name was Marlon McGrath Lewis, that SAT scores and grade point averages were almost of no importance in the admissions decisions at Harvard. You had to have, she said, a record of proven excellence. The admissions director at Princeton told me that the first thing he looks for, unless your dad is willing to donate a new science building or something like that, is your hobbies. But I was told to leave hobbies off. On the contrary, he said, or au contraire from the French speakers, it's the only honest information that exists on a kid's record, what they do when nobody's telling them what to do. Whoa, what hobbies are most important, he said. Well, he said, the absolute pinnacle are the hobbies where you risk life and limb, where if you don't know what you're doing, you're likely to end up dead or crippled, like trail riding on a spirited horse. And if you don't understand that if a limb intersects with your neck, that you will be the headless horse person. Notice how I edited that to be politically correct at the end. Tori said, take one of these 12-foot sailboats out of sight of land all by yourself. If a wind comes up and you don't know what you're doing, he said, you're likely to end up 100 miles out in the Atlantic and be dead. So there. So I'll find my place. I must stick to the script. Here we are. All right. The Athenians. Now, I have a reason for mentioning the Athenians. Like all tricky Italians, they will reemerge later on. So this is not vamping till ready. So, to Athenians, forced training of any sort was for slaves. Learning grew only from voluntary acts of self-discipline, not from pedagogy. Indeed, the term pedagogy in the ancient world denoted the training given by slaves known as pedagogues. How do you suppose a term like that survived into your own time? That's not a rhetorical question. It's a mystery, isn't it? As unbelievable as it sounds, classical Athens distributed all its important public jobs, like military commander or water commissioner, by lottery among citizens. Citizen names went into a big bowl, and the one emerging from a blind draw was it. Now, I know that some of you say, well, what a crazy system. And indeed, eventually, after hundreds of successful years, it was to doom Athens to the Syracuse expedition that eliminated Athens as a national power. So you think it's impossible today. That's because you've been carefully conditioned in school and through other professionals to believe in expertise. Who but a crazy would give such responsibility to just anybody? Isn't that right? But even if you're murderously insane in our own time, you can buy gasoline, can't you? And 5 gallons of gasoline has the explosive power of a stick of dynamite, don't it? And you were told that gasoline alone brought down the World Trade Center, weren't you? And at this very moment, outside this room, 1 million gasoline-powered vehicles are whizzing around the streets and highways of America, aren't they? Thousands of airplanes zipping through the skies, powered by gasoline. Can't anybody buy and use gasoline? I once knew a huge Hell's Angel biker who happened to be a science teacher at Booker T. Washington Junior High School. Tell the principal in a loud voice, mind you, that if he ever came and observed this guy's class, he said, "I know where you live, and I will bring a 5-gallon can of gasoline to your door, pour it under your door, light it, and laugh all the way home." Name was Berman. Berman the biker. Loves him. Here's Hughes. He's fabulous. So silly, isn't it, to think that ability is rationed? Can't anybody drive an automobile at highway speeds? Anybody with, 10 hours of training? Some with less than 10 hours of training. Whenever it suits the people behind the mirrors in the world you and I live in to allow it, it's allowed. That is personal power. Teaching flourished in Athens, but it was all entrepreneurial. No teacher worked under the thumb of bureaucrats. Schooling existed without bells, paper tests, or compulsion. Study was considered to be its own reward, and for most people, it was and is, until they've been driven insane by fear in schooling. Schools in America tended toward the Athenian ideal, except in the Lancaster chain of schooling for the poor, which I'll talk about a little later. Until after the Civil War, when a schism occurred, which still exists, some preparatory schooling still preserved Athenian ways, but public schooling did it less and less. And after World War II, public schools, almost all of them, were held to a different standard. And that was the standard of Athens' neighbor, Sparta, in the ancient world. Spartan society was a universal schoolhouse. Cradle-to-grave schooling was standardized. The common population followed official directions every waking minute, as you and I do, although we don't realize that apart from work, our behavior is studied by agencies like Google, which knows more about you than you know about yourself. Spartan politics were built around an illusion of public representation, just like ours is. But it was a sham arranged to befuddle the public. What the people saw was an executive branch, just like ours, two legislative branches, just like ours, and a high court. But real policy was never made in these dummy organizations. It was made by a small elite called the E4s, which passed its wishes to government figureheads for implementation. This Spartan Hall of Mirrors structure was the inspiration for political thinkers down through history, men like Machiavelli and Hobbes, or Stalin, FDR, and Mao. It passed into American policy largely from the German military state of Prussia. At our national beginnings, admiration for Prussia was sky high. Prussia had supported our revolution. The greatest thinker of the age Immanuel Kant lived and taught there, Prussia had consciously modeled itself after Sparta. And like Sparta, it was a universal schoolhouse. By 1820, following a pedagogical blueprint set down by the Prussian philosopher Johann Fichte, F-I-C-H-T-E, Prussia had succeeded in establishing the world's very first successful system of compulsory schooling, deliberately as a way to create human resources out of human beings for business, for the army, and for political managers. Schools in Prussia were the direct link between Spartan schooling and what has become common practice in the United States after World War II. Prussian schooling was imitated all over the world, as far away as Japan. Think of Athenian citizenship as a loose, playful, artistic association of near equals. Think of the Spartan counterpart as tight, rule-bound, aggressively competitive, and under control of an elite which manipulated appearances to make it appear that ordinary lives were important, although among the ephors they counted for nothing. Our own Federal Reserve banking system is Spartan to the core, and its managers are exclusively drawn from our own version of ephors or their proteges. What universal force schooling signified to leaders of a Spartan cast of mind is best expressed by the Roman writer Varro, V-A-R-R-O, in these words, and I dare you to challenge my Latin accent because I was an altar boy, instituit pedagogus, docet magister, the master orders, the slave pounds it in. Part 3, the first purpose. There are three popular arguments that society uses to justify ordering children into schooling. The oldest and the least used today is the religious purpose, to make good human beings. Every religious tradition on record, even the godless ones like Buddhism, defines characteristics of goodness and non-goodness. What's common to all is an assertion that existence has transcendental aspects, something beyond the material order. All teach reverence for this non-materiality. Transcendence doesn't require a belief in God, however. It can be approached in purely secular circumstances through art, music, dance, sculpture, literature, poetry, and contemplation, among other things. A school need not be overtly religious to celebrate a religious purpose. It need only acknowledge by its actions that rationality stops far short of the whole truth. First purpose schooling was the original catalyst for institutional schooling of all sorts, and it dominated until about two centuries ago, and it still survives in unexpected places. You'll be surprised, I think, to learn that a full 55% of all elite private boarding schools and day schools celebrate a religious mission, including the Sidwell School in Washington, D.C., selected by Bill and Hillary Clinton for their daughter, Chelsea. Sidwell, in its official literature, promises, quote, a religiously guarded education. It's ironic to realize that the well-to-do of America take pains to be sure their own children will consider the ultimate mysteries while denying such an option to children in ordinary circumstances or worse. Religion plays a much larger role in the modern world's business than the many reports of crazed religionists we hear about constantly from journalism would seem to suggest. For instance, the head of the Human Genome Project is a declared born-again Christian, wrote a beautiful book 2 years ago. I believe it's called The Voice of God. I would urge you to read it. It's not very long. Modern Israel is a theocratic state, plain and simple, exactly the way John Calvin's Geneva was centuries ago, and the prosecution of war criminals after World War II in Germany had to proceed on the basis of a concept known as natural law, God's law, since the Nazis were obsessively law-abiding, where secular or positive law was concerned. So religion still matters, and still, for many, teaching goodness is schooling's main purpose. Part four, the second purpose. The second purpose of schooling is to make good citizens, people who will serve the general good, not merely their own. It comes to us from ancient Greece and Rome. It reached a crescendo in the 125 years between 1776 and 1955 in revolutionary America, revolutionary France, revolutionary Italy, revolutionary India, revolutionary Russia, revolutionary China, and revolutionary Cuba. If the religious purpose of schooling is to make good people, the public purpose is to make good citizens. Unless ordinary people are deeply involved as working partners in government, the chances are good their leaders will betray them. Although that sounds cynical, I do not mean it to be. Our founding generation couldn't find a single historical example of a government that did not become corrupt. Read the Federalist Papers, which used to be, when I was growing up in a coal mining town, required reading in all American high schools, but which have totally vanished about a half century ago. To be effective, a citizen requires a great deal of raw experience with people, places, ideas, and things. Skills which simply cannot be memorized, but have to be experienced. And also they need a ready stock of facts, opinions, and examples drawn from history, economics, literature, philosophy, theology, and science, as well as from the creative arts. Most important is that skill with language and with the presentation of language. Any government or parent truly serious about making a citizen or enlarging his or her kids' opportunities would put public speaking and persuasive writing at the center of everything, including science study. Yet nowhere in the public arena is that true. What are we to make of its absence? Schools seem to bend over backwards to stifle citizenship and religious consciousness, perhaps because people so trained are exceedingly difficult to manage. Part 5. Rawa Dawa. Rawa Dawa. In Mundari, an obscure language with a sophisticated word stock, Rawa Dawa describes, quote, the sensation of realizing you can do something reprehensible and get away with it. Institutional schooling is like a great factory producing Rawa Dawa for its architects and managers. Rawa Dawa, Rawa Dawa. Part 6, the third purpose. The third common purpose of schooling is schooling for personal development. Today, that would be the most widely acceptable purpose used to justify forced schooling. It's an ambition once reserved for only a privileged fraction of the population. Once the Industrial Revolution threw off large surpluses, that idea spread to the imaginations of ordinary people, too. The phenomenal success of Ben Franklin's Poor Richard's Almanac and the cascade of success literature which fills bookstores today is a testimonial to the power of third purpose, private purpose schooling. Part 7, a fourth purpose. Now we must face reality, if Isaac will let us. Yes, Isaac, you can't tell me I have to get out for 50 more minutes. Now we must face reality. The three traditional purposes used to justify mass forced schooling are, each in its own way, intolerable to management. In a society organized like a joint stock company, a huge corporation, corporate logic is compelled to be rigorously pragmatic, grabbing any serendipitous opportunity which presents itself. And so the corporate ideal lives in absolute horror of principled people. Please don't think I'm speaking from an ideological perspective. The Jesuits in third grade would strike me when I deviated from full rationality there. It's simply boring. Dispersed the bonus marchers from Depression-era Washington, D.C., even though every one of them had been American soldiers. The cavalry was led by General Douglas MacArthur and his aide, Major Dwight D. Eisenhower, waving sabers. Private mercenaries working for Andrew Carnegie attacked the steel workers striking at Homestead near Pittsburgh. Rockefeller's private army attacked 9,000 striking coal miners with machine gun bearing armored cars in Ludlow, Colorado. No one ever went to jail for these uses of private army. Hired mobsters paid by Henry Ford opened fire with automatic weapons on the strikers at the River Rouge plant in 1933. And only yesterday, a religious colony in the desert outside Waco, Texas, far enough from Waco that you'll have to ask 8 people where it is before someone says, I think it's that way, down dirt roads between the cactus plants, this religious colony was burned to death by the United States government. You may remember that one. These symbolic public incidents are useful when grouped together because they allow a glimpse behind the curtain of management in our Hall of Mirrors society. You might imagine any serious history curriculum would focus attention on them, not to mindlessly denounce American policy, but to see reality as it is. In the words of John Stuart Mill, and I'm quoting from his essay on liberty, "The only way a human being can approach knowing the whole of an idea is by hearing what can be said about it by persons of every variety of opinion, and by studying all modes in which it can be looked at by every character of mind. No wise man ever acquired wisdom in any mode but this." If your brains are scrambled by one-sided propaganda, whether it comes from Fox News, National Public Radio, or a school textbook, you can kiss your shot at wisdom goodbye. But it constantly tempts policymakers to have that happen to you, usually not for any motives more ugly than that it makes their own jobs easier. Call it efficiency. Part 8, the leadership mind. In 1890, William James of Harvard, creator of American academic psychology as a science, wrote, I'm quoting from Psychology, "Habit alone is what saves the children of fortune from the envious uprisings of the poor. Habits of deference, habits of suggestibility, habits of regarding people in the same boat as yourself, as competitors." Shortly after James wrote that, our institutional schooling was set into motion for the very first time, fashioned by the children of fortune to teach habits to the envious poor. Track the leadership mind through recent history, and you will see that William James was only echoing the attitudes of his class. Winston Churchill, for instance, not Saddam Hussein, was the first person ever to order poison gas use from the air against the civilian population. He did that to the Kurds in what eventually became Iraq. And stung by criticism of this murderous decision, Churchill defended himself with these words in 1918. I'm quoting, "I don't understand squeamishness about the use of gas. I am strongly in favor of using poison gas against uncivilized tribes." It's a shame he didn't mean the English. Female leaders given a chance have shown a similar disdain for the unfortunate. Victoria Woodhull, not Hillary Clinton, was the first American woman to testify in front of Congress, the first female stockbroker, and the first lady to publish a newspaper. In 1872, she officially ran for the American presidency. And in her book, The Rapid Multiplication of the Unfit, which is still in print, by the way, she warned against the incurable biological depravity of the poor. What kind of schools that Mrs. Woodhull or William James or Winston Churchill would have signed off on, I don't need to leave to your imagination, since they are all around you. Part 9, the Empire in India. What gave Force Schooling its final liftoff energy was a discovery made during the British conquest of India during the last decades of the 18th century, at roughly the same time or a little after the American Revolution. India was a much greater prize to Britain than America because of its potential as an opium producer. Its docile population could work the crop, and its proximity to China as a major market for the stuff could be ensured by the actions of General Gordon, who thankfully was killed at Khartoum. A half century of the British Raj made Britain the narcotic supplier to the entire world. Not British gangsters, mind you, but the British government. But an even greater promise of wealth than drugs lay in the discovery of Hindu India's method of controlling its enormous population through mass schooling of the underclasses. Under the pretext of teaching literacy, while actually teaching habit training through the pairing of behavior to bells and commands, and attitude training by the inculcation of selected narratives in the minds of the confined children. The Hindu system was cheap and effective. One teacher could handle as many as 1,000 children through a division of the class into student-supervised groups whose student officers saw to it that the orders were followed by all. This monitorial organization gave the scheme its name, monitorial schooling. It did teach very low-level literacy, but at the price of robotizing the young. A British military chaplain named Andrew Bell saw the utility of such a system to social class-driven Britain, and he wrote an analytical essay to that end, which was published in London in 1798. That was the beginning of factory schooling in Britain, America, Canada, Australia, and all Britain's possessions. Because a half-mad 20-year-old Quaker named Joseph Lancaster, misreading Bell's essay as a blessing for the poor, began a monitorial school at once in an alley beside his London home. This first Lancaster school became an overnight international sensation. Lancaster himself taught 1,000 street urchins at a time to read under monitorial direction. And he was patronized by the wealthy and finally summoned for an audience with the British king. Almost at once, the Church of England saw a mortal danger to the class system in universal literacy. What if this insane Quaker scheme actually succeeded in perverting the Hindu design? What if Lancaster unleashed a generation of urchins capable of reading Tom Paine's Rights of Man or the Lessons of the French Revolution? Or, God forbid, coal miner kids reading Julius Caesar and Marcus Aurelius. In well-bred panic, the Church of England summoned Chaplain Bell back from India to set up a home-based Anglican system of monitorial schools, one intended to teach reading to a minimal degree and to teach that it was a waste of time to read original sources when friendly authorities had digested the books for you, and an encyclopedia entry would tell you what, or a comic book would tell you what the book said. Unable to compete with the church's prestige, Lancaster fled to America in 1818, where he found patronage under DeWitt Clinton and Thomas Eddy, the builder of the Erie Canal. By 1825, Lancaster's monitorial schools were in every large city east of the Mississippi. But as his system grew, Lancaster's hope for common high-level literacy was perverted by local entrepreneurs who sought to please local wealth and prominent people by teaching ordinary children very little beside knowing their place. When Lancaster was killed in a carriage accident, his dream of educating the commonality instead of schooling them died with him. Mass schooling remained in the hands of those who would use it to propagandize the poor and control them. The ruthless technology of fourth purpose schooling was now in the driver's seat. It awaited only the defeat of the South in the Civil War to burst out of its monitorial straitjacket into the hands of governments with police powers to order compliance from all. Part 10, train them early. Train them early, the Bible says, and later they will not stray from the right path. Who could argue? And yet, who will be given the authority to pick the right path? Let me show you the possible significance of that abstract question. Suppose the administrator of pathway selection, if you'll allow me a euphemism, didn't actually believe that all children are created equal. Suppose instead that he sincerely, I'm not being sarcastic, believed that the majority of children were intellectually or spiritually or psychologically inferior and no remedy was possible. Suppose further our administrator sincerely believed this inferior majority constitutes a deadly menace to superior folk, and yet is numerically so overwhelming it cannot be physically held down forever. What would our sincere administrator be able to do with his limited strength to protect the best people while rendering the worst harmless? Wouldn't a promising line of attack be to take command of the children of the dangerous mass and to train them early? First step, to win cooperation from their parents by causing the parents to believe that what you were doing was in the best interests of children. Then, by a judicious application of carrots and sticks, you would reward some families, punish others, and leave the great middle in hopeful and also fearful anticipation, thoroughly divided from one another, from the lessons of their cultures, their religions, their ancestors, and the strength that comes from unity. Follow me on this line a little longer. Once the parents have been conquered through division, the children are your clan. Now, if you impose an environment of constant stress on children amidst a background of shouts, orders, screams, spitballs, and bells, it will be hard to notice the lack of intellectual rigor in what you're doing. In such a climate, the psyche is conditioned to seek relief. And whether that relief, believe it or not, I wrote this morning at 6 a.m., is provided in the form of gold stars and praise, childish games and childish music, gin and beer or marijuana, there would be stupendous profits available to those who understood how to exploit the psychological fallout from deliberately imposed boredom and meaninglessness. Do policy thinkers actually talk like this outside your earshot? Have you ever heard the Watergate tapes? Have you ever read tobacco companies' internal memos which have been revealed in court cases? The internet's full of them. Can you recall Winston Churchill's enthusiasm for gassing the lesser peoples? Do you think Churchill would draw the line at drugging them too? Especially since drug peddling was, and perhaps is, the basis for so many British family fortunes. Do you think any of these people would draw the line at dumbing your children down? Ironically, the era in which the outlook about the utter dispensability of ordinary people was being most firmly established in the Western world was also a time when Christian morality, I'm not being sarcastic, Dickens, Christmas Carol, and all that, was the announced gold standard of public conduct. How on earth, in such a consciously moral environment, could anything as richly cynical as an institution of forced child confinement sold as education come about? Part 11, the Darwin Game. Part of the answer to this seeming contradiction comes from the artificial climate of fear deliberately imposed from many authoritative sources, including the pulpit, as we've seen in the case of dumbed down schooling to preserve the class system and the Church of England's part in that, and especially from the burgeoning university establishment, which pronounced the poor as hopeless and irredeemable, as we shall see. At this, none was so effective as the group I call the Darwin Gang. If you spend some time looking into the record of big-time thinking in Western history, big-time thinking that shows sympathy for ordinary people, you will find, with the exception of a few minor voices like Tolstoy and Gandhi, that the only influential document that exists is the New Testament of the Bible. There are no other defenses of ordinary people. But there's a long list of violent attacks on the dangers represented by the ordinary. We could begin with two utopias written in prehistory by Mr. Plato. The Republic is the more famous of the two, and the Laws is much the most explicit. But from Plato, there's a steady line right down to this moment. I only touch some of the high points. Institutes of the Christian religion, which was the Bible of the Protestant Reformation, coming out of Geneva, Switzerland, a theocracy like modern Israel, the Institutes of the Christian Religion set up in minute detail exactly the system of universal forced schooling we have, its division into classes, It's setting people against one another into competition. It's filling their heads with half-truths and nonsense. And Calvin, being a lawyer, thinking like a lawyer, very clearly says there are too many of the doomed for us to overwhelm by force. We will use force, and we'll pretend that it's a lot stronger than it really is, but in fact, we're going to have to make these people their own jailers. Now, that's Christian religion. But then leap to what every college in America teaches as the great liberal philosopher of the last 500 years, Benedict Spinoza. I know that if you've gone to college, heard he was Baruch Spinoza, but in fact, he was thrown out of the synagogue and told, "Never come back, you heathen." And he never signed his name Baruch Spinoza in his life. He signed it Benedict Spinoza, just like the current Pope. Anyway, in 1690, Spinoza published a book which you never heard about, even though your local librarian can secure it for you quite easily, or you can buy it through Amazon. It's called Tractatus Religico Politicus, and shortened to the Tractate among people in the know. In the Tractate, published in 1690, and intended only for the crowned heads and nobility of Europe and for the leaders of the new colony in America, Spinoza says, the overwhelming mass of ordinary people are murderously irrational, and there is no cure for that. Notice he's echoed Calvin and Plato, but Calvin did it on political grounds or metallurgical grounds, and Calvin did it on message straight from the boss upstairs. No, Spinoza was more sophisticated. He said psychologically, their heads are diseased. And unless you can fill their heads with nonsense, divide them from their parents and their cultures and their religions, and establish a civil religion through schooling, which will dole out rewards to the compliant, these people will sooner or later figure it out and murder you in your beds. If I tell you that the Tractatus was easily one of the 10 most influential documents in human history, and probably one of the 3 or 4 in modern history, I'm not exaggerating. So the fact you never heard of it is not a condemnation of your ignorance, but whoever was entrusted, whether that's PS9 or Harvard, with letting you know, letting you see behind the curtain, they screwed you, and that's the truth. Anyway, let's get back to the script. For your own protection, Spinoza's very accurate reworking of Calvin's, very accurate reworking of Plato, was reworked one final time before, like the demon in The Exorcist, it leaped into the American spirit. And that was in Prussian Germany. Prussian Germany was a religious state, although you'll never hear that from a school teacher, and probably rarely from a college teacher. It was the creation of the Pope in Rome from the last crusade that you never have heard of. It was the crusade against the heathens in Northern Europe, the Prus, they were called. And an order was founded called the Teutonic Knights. There's a gorgeous, gorgeous portrait of Adolf Hitler in the gleaming silver armor of the Teutonic Knights that was issued as a national poster across Germany when he took office, to let the Germans know that the religious mission was back on, to exterminate the heathen Slavs. They were in Russia, and a few other heathens, whichever heathens he could lay hands on there. See, there's this whole corpus of information that you do not have to go to conspiracy theorists to tap into. What you have to do is go to the original historical sources and not trust the fact that your $50 history textbook is not some controlled narrative too, even at Harvard. By the way, I spoke at Harvard Kennedy School of Government last year. They gave me credit for introducing the phrase dumbing us down worldwide, and I said the same thing to them as I'm saying to you right now, although this is the first time this has ever been presented as a talk. So every responsible thinker in Western history, right down through William James to much subtler 20th century thinkers who've learned to speak circumspectly, has agreed that the common people have to be neutralized. The only debate between Britain and the United States, for example, is how many, what fraction of the population is hopeless and dangerous. Britain maintained that it was 90%, but the United States, being the liberal home of the free that it is, argued for 80%. And I think that's where current policy thinking remains there. So how do you do this? What's the mechanism to do this? Well, memorizing lists has to replace primary experience. As you may have gleaned from this Quebec farmer's clear understanding that simply raw experience, if it's diverse enough, and running a farm demands this diversity of skills, will do it all by itself. Not that it can't be augmented, but without the experience, the rest of it is garbage. You're a puppet without realizing it. Google knows more about you than you know about yourself. Of course, the CIA knows more about Google than Google knows about itself. Oh, God. So memorizing lists had to replace primary experience. Deep analytical explorations, which develop concentration, have to be scrupulously avoided. The only common characteristic of brilliant people, or if you look at theories of brilliance, the only characteristic everyone agrees on is brilliant people can lock out the world and concentrate as long as it takes. This has been understood for an awfully long time. Why else do you think that every 43 minutes a bell is rung in your ears? And inside that theoretically sacrosanct 43 minutes, the loudspeaker makes announcements two or three times a period. And if it's not the loudspeaker, a messenger pounds on the door. And if it's not that, some loutish kid bored out of his mind farts a lot. It's a laboratory of anti-concentration. Almost nobody escapes a 12-year drill in that. If your kid walks in on computer games and goes all night long. Well, if you're a Roman Catholic, you'll cross yourself, and then you'll say, look, you can do that if you extract the logic of the computer games you're playing often enough that they bore you because you can anticipate what the programmer built into the game, and then you design games, and then you study like an anthropologist the cultural habits of the game industry and the way they're publicized, and you make a fortune or at least die trying. You know, come home with your shield or honor. Then, if you want to watch these stupid games for the rest of your life, when it's spring and the girls are out there on the street, you just go ahead, you jerk. But don't be surprised when I disinherit you. Okay. So, we're on to the actual mechanism, which is now replacing education. You memorize lists, you deprive people of primary experience. Anything they look likely to concentrate on, which is almost certainly something of their own choosing, you forbid that. Or you allow it in measured doses if they do what you tell them to do. You make only a confused version of reality available to the kids on which to base decisions. Let me give you an example of that that all of you have been put through. In 10 years of trying with audiences very intelligent, many members of which are surely more intelligent than myself, I have never encountered a single person who understands why the American government has its power divided among an executive branch, two legislative branches, and a judicial branch. Had you ever bothered to read the Federalist Papers? And why should you? It's hard reading. It will give you a headache. And if you went to school in a coal mining town in the 1940s, you would have read it or been struck physically. You would have learned that the founders of the nation were so sophisticated that they understood there is no such thing as good power and bad power. All power is inherently evil. As Lord Acton said, power corrupts. Absolute power, such as the power your school has over your children, corrupts absolutely. People who exercise power are corrupt. No matter how many times they go to church or shake their fist at Tiger Woods, they are deeply corrupt. And the founders knew that. So the question was not how to improve on the design the founders gave us, although it bore some improvement, but to make the act of improving it so bloody difficult that most people who couldn't concentrate would simply give up and leave the thing intact. So you divide powers to make sure that it's hard to get anything done. You have to get everybody on the same page, and there's not enough bribe money in the world to do that very often. Because surely, and this is probably the only single case where Pat Frank and I would disagree, there are no advances in human history that have come about through negotiation. It's simply drawing a line in the sand and saying, if you cross that line, I will kill you. It's that simple. And if the enemy says, but we outnumber you 50-1, you can say, the French warriors outnumbered the Romans 50-1. And France became a Roman province. Knock me down, I'll get back up again. Kill me, I'll become a martyr. That's why they put Desmond Tutu in jail for... No. What's it? 28 years! But he was able to concentrate. I hadn't figured on that. He didn't drink, he didn't watch television, he didn't smoke dope. I got a 10-minute signal, and I have an hour left. So let's get on to this. You can also, following Calvin and Spinoza and Plato, fill their heads with nonsense and half-truth. Plato called it the big lie, so he's the clearest and the brightest of the three men. So you commit that to memory, and you publicly honor the people who fill their heads with garbage. That's either the parts I didn't transcribe there. So, anti-common philosophical theory existed all through history. But in the West, for a while, it was countered by Christian theory. I'm not trying to proselytize you, although I'd love to do that. It was countered by, listen, I'm a follower of a Jewish carpenter who liked his glass of wine and did some neat tricks, like walking a wire and raising the dead. What's not to like? So according to Christian theory, it wasn't the poor who would have trouble getting salvation. It was the rich and powerful who would. I mean, this is revolutionary stuff, man. That's why we had to have a Protestant Reformation. Apologies to all you Protestants. The writings of three British cousins, and let me get the Darwin gang out, and then I'll say goodbye. The writings of three British cousins in the 19th century, Thomas Malthus, Charles Darwin, and Francis Galton, upset this delicate balance between Christian theory and secular philosophical theory. They threw the prestige of science and mathematics decisively on the side of exclusionary thinking, issuing a license in effect for school to protect the best biological stock from the bad by dumbing the bad down. First cousin Malthus. He taught at the training college for executives serving the British East India Company's narcotics monopoly. Malthus in 1798, I believe, but it may have been 1801, wrote an influential essay proving mathematically that the poor could never be fed because they reproduced geometrically 2, 4, 8, 16, while food could only be increased arithmetically, 1, 2, 3, 4. So it was a losing game. And he was a vicar of the Church of England also, he actually had the colossal gall to say that working the poor to death was a great Christian mercy because it shortened their suffering. Sorry about that. Don't tell me that you're going to negotiate with these people. When your good example will bring them along. When your boots on their neck, they'll come along. Their situation was so hopeless, said Malthus, that it was folly to even try. The birth rate among the poor must decline. One way to do that was to make birth control technology widely available. Another was to encourage childishness among the common population so that the awful prospect of having to work to support a family would discourage the childish from breeding, you know, thus freeing those Swedish, German, and English blondes from unfavorable attention. Yet another way, and this didn't happen until the middle of the 20th century, although it was conceived of a century earlier, another way was to flood young males with legal pornography so their sexual feelings could be gratified through fantasy, now through the internet. I hope you know that 75% of all internet use is porno site hits. What a harem is available. Another was forcibly sterilizing the unfit with or without their knowledge. In the century and a half after Malthus, every one of these methods was employed in the West, and all of them in our own country. America's forced sterilization program was legitimatized by the U.S. Supreme Court in Buck versus Bell, 1925, I think. Pornography began to flood public newsstands in the late 1950s, thanks to Supreme Court ruling and not allowing it. And school became active in artificially extending childishness far beyond its natural limits almost the same time period. Cousin number two, Charles Darwin himself, is best known for his theory of natural selection, which pronounced that creatures improve themselves, hey, through deadly competition. Echoing Thomas Hobbes, the philosopher of big central government, Darwin said it was nature's law, too. A law which led to the best prevailing, the worst dying off, concealed from those who read books secondhand. Was that Darwin believed that only a small favored fraction was actually evolving. The majority of people were biological dead ends. In the blink of an eye, Darwin issued a license written by science for managers all over the world to operate with a clear conscience and with maximum prejudice against those not favored by nature. In his book, Descent of Man, you owe it to yourself, if you're Irish, even a small fraction, to read it. Because of all the inferior biology on earth, Darwin said the Irish were the most hopeless. This is the man in every classroom and library in the United States. Nor is the idea of evolution Darwin's. You know, you can find it in Aristotle and all the way through history. That's what they used to call a red herring to throw you off the track of his theory of sexual selection being the way evolution proceeds. You know, that's getting a Swedish blonde or something. So, Darwin issued a license to do what schools do very well. They track people. So, he also included Italians in the inferior group, Spaniards in the inferior group, Jews in the inferior group, and a whole long list of the other biological losers of history. He said, if the good stuff crossbred with the bad stuff, evolution would march backwards into the swirling mists of the dawnless path, into the swamps. Time over, it says, you gotta hear Galt. Galt will only take another minute. In fact, I won't even use it. Darwin's first cousin, Mr. Galton, was, like Darwin, a supremely wealthy man. Your history books or your science books don't tell you that. They were supremely wealthy people. They hobnobbed with dukes, princes, crowned heads of the world's nations. So what they said resonated very efficiently. And Galton set out to translate Darwin's natural selection into school structure and procedures. Made several visits to the United States. The purpose of institutional schooling, he said, was, and he invented this word, eugenics, the science of breeding the best with the best. And in order to do that, because of America's ungodly liberal history, where people actually planned their own lives and raised their own children, because of that, he said, we have to do this circumspectly by tagging the inferior with all sorts of labels, humiliating them in front of other people in school, and making them undesirable choices in the marriage sweepstakes. I mean, I was taught in high school, and I imagine it was done all over the United States, that Galton was the single most brilliant person as measured by IQ tests in human history. I heard that every year. Of course, I heard every year, too, that Piltdown Man was the missing link between monkeys and human beings. They were always not told that it was a carefully arranged fraud, which is another one of the wonderful truths taught in school. So Galton took Darwin and institutionalized Darwin through schooling all over the world. The racial policies of Japan today are as old as 1868, when the Meiji Restoration, I'm sure I mispronounced Japanese too, installed the Prussian system of schooling, which, as you now know, was the British system, the Indian system under the Hindus, the British system, back to Sparta there. That's the chain. I'm giving you each three credits. You just tell them you took them at Gather University. God bless you all.
Thank you so much, John.
The dead, and it's not above taking a glass of wine from time to time. Give it a second. All
right. Before everybody leaves, I have just a couple very quick important announcements.
I will talk to you now.